Unified with Momobo Ogoro. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Unified. This is a show where we listen, learn, laugh, and ultimately unify across our differences. We speak to people from different and diverse communities all over Ireland and hear their stories and perspectives. My name is Momobo Ogoro, your host, and you can get in touch with Unified by emailing unified@newstalk.com. That's unified with a Y-O-U. Coming up on today's show, our panel will be discussing LGBTQ plus representation on TV. Dancer and choreographer Lapri Lala, who will be showing us how inclusivity can be created through choreography. And lastly, Filipino Festival Ireland will be coming to us this month, and I'll be talking to the organisers. But first, from period dramas to sitcoms, many of us have seen LGBTQ plus characters on screen, and they have changed the attitudes and lives. For many of people, seeing LGBTQ plus characters on screen was the first glimpse of possibility, acceptance, and openness towards themselves and others. So today we're going to be looking at shows that broke ground in its time and the portrayals that maybe haven't aged so well, and the characters that have generally changed culture. So we'll be discussing this with Oisin O'Reilly, CEO of Outhouse LGBTQ Plus Centre, and Tom Donnelly, News Talk producer. Welcome, folks. So when it comes to LGBTQ Plus characters that we've seen over the years, first and foremost, I want to ask, Tom, as we start with you, what is a character that has transformed your perception of yourself?
It's a really good question, Momobo, because it took a long time for me to see a character on screen who I felt reflected or explained or drew a pathway for me as a gay man. Probably the breakthrough TV series for me was Queer as Folk, the original British TV production on Channel 4, which broadcast literally around the time that I was coming to terms with my sexuality. Up to that point, I had seen gay, lesbian, less so bisexual or trans characters on TV, but I hadn't seen a lifestyle, something that was almost like celebratory of sexuality, that wasn't necessarily an exploration of neuroses or fear or guilt, perhaps. So watching those characters, watching Stuart and Nathan, young, sexually active, party life, whilst also dealing with jobs and school and family, for the first time, I looked at something and I thought, that is what perhaps a gay life might look like. And that was eye-opening for me.
And that's a beautiful way to kind of see yourself to it, that it's not just linked with fear, guilt, shame. It's actually linked to the broader, your broader humanity. And that's beautiful to see. And yourself, Oisin, what was the story or character that brought this to life for you?
Yeah, I think there's no one. I think for me, growing up in the 90s, I was always looking for that, story that would resonate with how I felt and experienced the world. And it was those little kind of breadcrumbs in other stories. We were always the side character, generally the butt of the joke, or the mildly inconvenient one, but never a fully rounded emotional person with an entire backstory. We never took center stage. And I remember for me as a child thinking about, well, what does that mean for how my life will be? Is that what my life is destined to be, that I will always be the sidekick to someone else's story as opposed to having my own full story? And, you know, kind of when I look at it and listening to Tom talk about Queer as Folk there, I found that a little bit later. I'm not going to lie, I didn't have access to that or access to the television at that hour of the day to be able to watch it, you know. But seeing our identities in other TV shows a little bit just gave me that little bit of, okay, well, there we are. And we're not being vilified, you know. We're not being ridiculed in a way that I couldn't survive if that was what life was going to be like. So I think our representations of our identities become very, very formative. And I think really in the last decade or decade and a half, I've seen such a different resonance of queer characters and LGBTQ plus characters that resonate with different facets of my own identity in so many ways. The most recent being, and I know we'll get to it, Heated Rivalry, and how amazing an experience that was at the start of the year to see it, but also emotionally transformative for our community, I think.
And that's a beautiful thing. And you were talking about, like, as you were growing up in the 90s, there was this sort of not idea, reality, that a lot of LGBTQ characters were sideline characters, or they weren't, they were sidekicks, or they were coded as queer and not necessarily out. Can you talk to us a bit about why that was happening at the time? Or,
well, I think it was, you know, kind of really creatives doing their best to include complex stories and to try to meet society with where it was at, with the understanding of our identities and lived experiences. And I'm always mindful that any representation in books, in film, in television, even in radio, and in spoken word is a representative snapshot of where society is with those identities at that moment in time. And in a way, the belief about that limiting factor of how much society, inverted commas, will tolerate in how deep we go with some issues becomes the limiting factor for very complex identities, you know. And I suppose the simplification and stereotypical representations we saw in the 90s of our identities was maybe, I suppose, rooted in that. But that doesn't mean it's inherently bad either, you know?
Mm. I think that's a really good point, Momoba. And it resonates very strongly with me as somebody who came of age in the mid-90s, conscious that things were starting to change. Decriminalization here in 1993, when I was in my mid-teens, around the same time, the lifting of Section 28 in the UK, the ban on the promotion of homosexuality, and the sense that people were changing, society was shifting. So those early stage representations are exactly that. They feel at times tokenistic. The character of the gay best friend suddenly appears everywhere in TV dramas. You know, I think of people like Stamford Blatch in Sex and the City. You know, it's witty banter and it's a wry line. Also, essentially, people who are not sexual don't necessarily have agency. In film, I think of very much like Rupert Everett in My Best Friend's Wedding. And my recollection is that there was a shift in the culture which reflected that. Suddenly, everybody wanted a gay best friend, you know, and they were happy and comfortable for you to occupy that space. So it wasn't a full expression of our lives. It wasn't a full depiction or reflection of the reality of what it is to be queer and to live in the world. But there was a sort of a warmth there at the same time. And I think particularly for many young gay boys, it was that which helped to bring you along to what happened later on when people like us began to take center stage, when our stories began to be told. And also as something that we have all dealt with when those were tolerated, platformed in a way that wasn't just, this is a gay story. Mm-hmm. That stories can be told through the lens of gay, bisexual, trans, queer people.
And I find that transition as one taken quite a long time, as you know yourself, and specifically those stories that have come from the gay best friend trope, those queer coded stories as well. Wouldn't you think that it still like exists, or it's still like leaning on stereotypes and we still have to take people along the way?
I think we do. Mm-hmm. And I think that that tendency will always be there. But I suppose a little bit to what Oisin said earlier, we can still take that fact of the gay best friend as a reality, as a part, a small part. It's the in. But increasingly, we're seeing other stories told through a lens. So we can tell a story about family difficulties or the world in which we live or a comedy where there are queer characters, but they're not talking about their sexuality or their sexual identity all the time. So I think there has been a significant movement towards that. You have characters now in TV, everything from comedy to drama to period drama, who are gay, bisexual, lesbian and trans. But that's not what's there for discussion. I watch Bridgerton, I'll put my hands up. We don't talk about Benedict Bridgerton's sexual fluidity all that much. It's there, it's depicted, it's in the background. But the core of the story is still what's going to happen to this family, who's going to marry who, who's going to inherit what, who's going to wear the nice dresses, what are they going to dance to at the ball? So it's there and it's in the background. I look too at characters like the great André Breuer, who died relatively recently as Captain Holt in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Mm. Like the epitome of a strong, black, mask-presenting man. He just happens to be gay. Okay. But that's not integral to the storyline or the comedy of Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
That's beautiful. And it's great to kind of see how it's just embedded in the story. It's not the story itself. And it kind of makes it normal, quote unquote, in terms of just it's an everyday human experience. It reminded me of an experience that I had actually like a week ago. And I was watching a movie with my housemates, and we were watching a movie, and the movie was talking about, it was about the mafia, essentially. And there was a character that was gay. Nobody paid any attention to it because we're so used to seeing it. But there was a character that was trans. The character didn't talk about being trans. The character didn't have anything about being trans. But that was where some of my housemates focused on. Mm. And then I had this reflection of like, you didn't even pay any attention to the gay character because we're so used to seeing gay characters right now. But we're not used to seeing trans characters and their lived experiences. So that was where you focused on. So it's, I feel this transition is now happening to non-binary and trans folk in terms of having the representation there that's not fixed on their experience, but having people just be used to seeing it. So that transition is something that needs to happen subtly, in my opinion, but on an ongoing basis to stories that say their lived experience, but not necessarily that is the entire story. So I hear what you're saying, Tom, in terms of how we can actually start to move towards that area. And even today and how stories are being told, I know we're going to be talking about heated rivalry and other things like that. But for young people today watching these stories or even looking back as well, how do you see it transition for young people today, Oisin?
I'd love to be a young person today growing up with kind of, rich protagonists with full emotional lives being displayed in so many different forms of the creative arts around our communities. Like, and also I think that there's something beautiful about where we've landed as a country and a society in like today's audiences. As much as our community really expect depth, complexity and authenticity when it comes to telling the real stories of gay, lesbian, bi, trans and queer people in a way that we haven't seen before. And we're definitely seeing that play out on screen. You know, I think of, you know, kind of Schitt's Creek and, you know, kind of the very nonchalant line of I like wine, not the label, to talk about pansexuality. And it became a cultural zeitgeist moment that I suppose educated, informed, demystified and simultaneously brought everyone in. Like, I can only imagine that being a young person now is quite uplifting and enlightening to be able to see that. Whereas I can remember my yearning and seeing the first trans representation I ever saw was in Eurovision being enamored in a really positive way and kind of going, and my parents are in the room and watching this with me. And I've got a little like candle of joy burning inside me as I see someone who connects to my worldview and experience in a way. So like when I hark back to my younger self, I'm kind of like, maybe a little bit jealous that a younger generation gets to have that a bit more now that I didn't. But in a warm kind of jealousy as opposed to an envious kind, you know?
Tom, do you feel that sort of warm jealousy as well?
I do a little, because when I think about it, we're talking about television. And television, as I explained, was my route through. I didn't have the internet, for example. There wasn't an ability to go online and find the tribe or find people whose stories were similar to my own. So I sought out those tiny little moments, those fragments through things like TV. And like Oisin, things like the Eurovision did give me those insights. I read books. When I was coming to terms with my own sexuality, I literally devoured fictional representations of gay characters to find them. Younger people today can immediately, in a touch, find that community, find stories, find paths, find examples to lead them in. I'm very happy about that. A little bit envious, perhaps more so than jealous, but I'm glad that it's there because it wasn't there when you were a little kid growing up in a small rural town in Tipperary in the 1980s.
And that transition is something that, myself included, is a bit envious in terms of how these young people are it's just normal for them. And it's normal to see the multitude of identities, experiences and humanity in terms of being a queer person in the modern day. And I know we're talking about stories and how those characters are being portrayed, but who the characters are played by as well is kind of an important thing to touch on. And I want to ask you both, when it comes to even LGBTQ plus characters and how they're portrayed on screen, do you believe that the artists or actors that are playing these characters should be LGBTQ plus themselves? Or do you feel that it's not adequate representation?
My own personal view is no. I think I suppose actors for time immemorial, have assumed an identity and a character. And I think there's something beautiful in the interpretation and representation of an identity. It is obviously open to interpretation, to fault and otherwise, but I think the frame of acting itself has always been thus. So why, for our identities, our experience, or our community, should it be any different? So I'm like, no, that's just the way it's been.
Yourself, Tom?
It's a difficult question because we've been talking a lot about the transition when television, film and depictions began to change. Obviously, like many people of my generation who were shaped by the legacy of the AIDS crisis, you know, we think back to films like Philadelphia and it's Tom Hanks playing a gay man with AIDS and winning awards for it. And those were formative and helped to change the culture. But it took a long time for actors who are themselves LGBT to assume those roles, to be in the headline on the marquee, and to then begin to win the awards. I will give great kudos to an actor that I have followed throughout my life on television. He was a huge part of my early introduction to what it was like, that experience of identifying as gay and coming out. And that's Wilson Cruz as Ricky Vasquez in My So-Called Life. So played by a young, gay, Hispanic man in America in the 1990s, coming out through difficulties with religion, with a traditional migrant family. Wilson Cruz now plays a doctor in a Star Trek spin-off called Star Trek Discovery. Happily married to a scientist, representing a normal, regular, it's still Star Trek, so it's off the wall at times, but he just plays a gay partner, a gay husband. And I do believe that the fact of Wilson's own sexual identity has made his characters realer for me through life. Perhaps I'm projecting onto a person I've absolutely never met, but I feel and believe his performance throughout. There's an essential intrinsic part that is not acting, it's being.
Mm. And that's a great take in terms of, and some people can think like, okay, acting is a performance. You have to, like you were saying, you have to put on or step into a character. But when does a character actually become the person, essentially, and how do you actually feel it in a way that it's authentic? I don't know if I want to use that word, you know?
Powerful.
You know, yeah.
But I also think that there's power in the likes of Tom Hanks in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And given the stature that Tom Hanks had within the acting profession and the profile within society at large, that actually he became an advocate for our community in a way that we can't always advocate for ourselves because of structural inequality. Mm. And, you know, we've heard countless tales of the professional lives of LGBTQ plus actors who have been limited because of their identity and warned never to come out, not to express their identity, that their careers will be over and otherwise. So I think that the power in assuming our full role or their full role, you know, kind of as Tom has outlined there in Star Trek, it's an amazing representation of identity. I've loved it. So I have. And it does feel really raw, raw, real and authentic within that universe. Equally so does Tom Hanks, because he brought a story to a mainstream audience that otherwise wouldn't have engaged with it. Yeah. And that was a powerful piece of advocacy.
And it's beautiful how it actually changed the attitudes more broadly of individuals, and that character particularly brought this level of social change that a lot of people wouldn't necessarily see as social change at the time, but it was a huge shift in terms of how people saw LGBTQ plus characters. And I know today's stories are completely different to stories in the 80s, 90s. And sometimes when I actually watch back, not just about LGBTQ plus issues, but other intersectional things, I kind of cringe in terms of how things are said or in terms of how people said or spoke about our stories. Do you cringe Tom, yourself when you look back on some of them? Or are you like, oh, that didn't land right?
I cringe all the time. Like, I cringe from the beginning of the kind of queer-coded characters I first saw as a child, you know, from Mr. Humphreys and Are You Being Served, you know, and I'm Free, right through the Carry On films that would be repeated on RTE in the afternoons, you know, and Kenneth Williams and the kind of the wink and the nod and the ooh matron. And that little part of you inside is recognizing some link, but cringing at the expression of it. But it's being played for laughs. I cringe, and this is more in solidarity with trans brothers and sisters, in particular about the language that was used around trans identity and the transition process. But then I get to where we are today, and I look particularly at the, and I will give great kudos to soap operas, both in the UK and in Ireland, in the way that they introduced characters, gay, bisexual, trans, lesbian, and through that kind of naturalistic soap opera type writing that I think we in Ireland and the UK are particularly good at, we also teased out those things. So yes, you had the cringe moments, and yes, you had the language, but you also had the dialogue and the insights. Like, I think particularly about Coronation Street. Mm-hmm. I think about the portrayal of Hayley Cropper by Julie Hesmanha. Interestingly, not herself trans, you know, so going back to that point you made about representation, but you heard all of the usual cringy, difficult jokes, mistakes, misnaming, misgendering, all of that. But through this very sensitive portrayal and teasing out, you know, you get to a point where, right, we've moved away from cringe and into a kind of acceptance. Like, I think LGBTQ representation can still deliver those cringe moments. Like, I thought a little bit about that when I was watching And Just Like That, the spin-off from Sex and the City. Delighted to see Miranda, mm-hmm. played by Cynthia Nixon, you know, engage with her own queerness. But I still felt that some of the language, the lines, the quips and jokes around her relationship with Shay were awkward. They felt mistimed, you know. I'm like, I don't actually believe that these smart, creative, powerful, wealthy people living in New York in the 2020s would actually speak to each other like this.
Oisin, do you cringe as well when you see these shows?
Yeah, like when I look back at how our identities were framed in the 90s and early 2000s, and I apply today's lens, I'm kind of like, oh, skin crawl feeling. But that said, it was so meaningful and powerful. Like, visibility was key at that moment in time. Any visibility, even though it be contested, was good. And it feels off now, but back then it was groundbreaking, earth-shattering, in the same way that the representations we've seen in Orange is the New Black have fundamentally moved dialogue and discourse within our community around race and representation and identity and sexuality, in the way Heated Rivalry has shifted the masculine norms about vulnerability and what it means to be a gay or queer man in the world today. And I have no doubt that if we're lucky to be back in 20 years' time and we look back at what has aired this year, we'll find fault with it. But that's part of the process of evolution of identity and language and understanding.
And it's a human process that needs to happen throughout the years. And I loved your reference in terms of we'll probably be looking back on, oh, that was a bit cringe, you know? And specifically, you touched on the story of Heated Rivalry. I know me and Tom that haven't watched it. Oisin, do you want to give us just a bit of insight of what the story is about and why it's so important?
Well, ultimately, at its heart, it's a love story. Mm-hmm. But it's a love story fraught with the journey of self-discovery and self-acceptance for two protagonists who have these exceptionally deep emotional lives. One of the things that it does beautifully is the bringing in of neurodivergence for the character of Shane in such a strong way. And we know that neurodivergence in our community is, you know, kind of, we may say two sides of the same coin in many ways. And it was done authentically, refreshingly. I think the emotional vulnerability, I think the raw passion within the story as well, the sense of yearning, the deep sense of fear that even still today, the fear of rejection is there for many, and that internal battle of reconciling one's identity and what this means for how you relate to the world, the people around you, how they will relate to you, and that while it's now increasingly more infrequent for familial rejection to happen when someone comes out, sadly, it still does happen. And that kind of plays out, that internal fight, the can I be myself authentically? Will I be loved, accepted, nourished, cherished? And it's just beautiful to come to life. For me, it felt like a whole coming out experience again, watching those six episodes. And I'm yearning for the next seasons to see where it goes. Yearning so much that I have a slight bit of fear that they're going to get it wrong. Just because I think the bar ended up getting set so high. You know, and then it's like, I hope the writers and you know, the screenwriters and the producers, like, they will do their best. I know they will. But they have an unenviable task for seasons 2 and 3.
Oh, I can imagine. And I've been seeing it everywhere on Instagram and TikTok. And everybody is like, you need to watch this. I've been seeing analysis of the show and everything like that, and how they decode even masculinity and what that looks like in a queer relationship as well. And that authenticity. So that's one of my to-do list over the summer, is just to sit down, binge Heated Rivalry. And I believe specifically on how we can actually create dialogue. It created so much dialogue in terms of, like I said earlier, what masculinity looks like, what that authentic expression, the fear around coming out, especially in today's world where you think like it's the norm, like you can, like you don't even need to come out, quote unquote, anymore. So it's, I can't wait to watch it myself, and I can't wait to dig deep into it. And even looking forward, folks, like when it comes to LGBTQ plus representation, when it comes to people seeing themselves authentically in different mediums, what are your hopes, Tom?
Well, funny, my first hope is actually rooted and grounded in that experience of Heated Rivalry, which I haven't yet seen. I've now reached a point in my life where previously, if we had a new hit TV show, or let's face it, any TV show, which was going to tell the story or platform LGBTQ people, I would have been there. I would have been looking for it before it was even out. Here I am today, knowing that it exists and people love it, but I don't have to rush to it as the only one. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That there are a plethora of representations. There are so many TV shows that tell stories or that platform us. And I'm really happy. I've been sitting for a while watching the response to Heated Rivalry and loving that it's there. And I don't need to run to find it. That's a big moment. I would like that to be the case going forward. When it comes to broader questions around representation, I think I've got to come back to the kind of intersectional point. Are we seeing enough of a variety? Are we being reflected in all our rainbow across the story types, across the personality types? Like, even if you think about living in a country like Ireland, increasingly multicultural, 1 in 5 of us not born here, that means if that's reflected within our community, that variation is there too. Class, race, religious and cultural experience. I would like to see a greater variety in that representation. And I think it will be there. I think too, and I will say this as a gay man, I think there is considerably less representation of women's experiences. Mm. There are relatively few. When I was thinking about a lot of lesbian representation, yes, there are the ones that we mentioned. A lot of the depictions on drama tend to be historical. You're more likely to see a lesbian woman depicted in a historical drama, probably adapted from a book, than you are living an authentic contemporary life. So I would like to see that happen too. And I think the final thing that I would like to see, or one of the last things I would like to see, are projects that are almost wholly delivered by people from within our community. Everything from the actors to the writers to the directors. Like, thinking of something which did have a big impact on me relatively recently, Ryan Murphy's Pose, kind of retelling the story of ballroom and voguing and what it was like to transition in the 1980s and 1990s. You know, a cast and a crew that was almost entirely queer. Trans people presenting trans stories. And I understand that there was a great sense of ownership, solidarity, and pride in that kind of project. It still made brilliant television. You didn't have to be gay to love Pose. You didn't have to be trans to understand the stories that were being told. You didn't have to be around during the AIDS crisis to understand what those threats felt like. So more of that, please.
Beautiful. And Oisin, yourself, what do you hope to see in the future?
Here, here. I couldn't agree with Tom anymore. And on Pose, it was community, culture and survival centered in one moment. It was absolutely beautiful. And I think, you know, kind of women's stories most definitely are underrepresented within what's available in film and television, and so much so is historical. And I really don't understand why we're focused on the past, you know, in kind of the Edwardian, Victorian, Regency eras to talk about women's stories in a way. And I love a good period drama, don't get me wrong, but it is a little bit troubling that we aren't seeing that modern representation of everyday life and experience for women. And I think thinking of another identity that is really only beginning to break through as well, are asexual members of our community. You know, we saw our first representations of asexual characters in sex education with the characters Florence and O, and just again being, and to your point, Momobo, weren't really coming out, they just were, you know, and that moment of just having arrived. And I think there's something inherently confronting about people just being for our community, because the thing that binds us together as a broad umbrella of LGBTQ plus communities is the experience of coming out. And if we are no longer coming out, what is the thread that binds us? And that's a question that I suppose, reckon with quite a bit. You know, when are we a community or are we communities? And how are we bound together in mutual aid and support and campaigning and advocacy and, you know, cheering one another along and helping one another along? It's a fascinating concept for me.
That's a great concept that I haven't even thought of myself, Oisin. So you've got me thinking. I'm like, that's a further conversation we're going to have. Well, thank you so much, folks, for the conversation. It was brilliant to have you on and to discuss this. I think a lot of people are still reckoning with the fact that we're going through a transition around LGBTQ plus characters and representation. And it's great to see the transition that has happened and where we're actually going again. So thank you so much again, folks. That is Oisin O'Reilly and Tom Donnelly. Those at home who are seeing LGBTQ plus characters, or if you have a characters that have changed your perception and your attitudes, you can let us know at unified@newstalk.com. Coming up after the break, dancer and choreographer Lapri Lala. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to Unified. Now, from global stages to community spaces, dance is not just a movement. It's culture, it's confidence, it's healing, it's connection. And for today's What's Your Story, I'm going to be speaking to Lapri Lala, who is an Afro and Amapiano dance artist, telling us about her story into dance. She's also the founder of Southside Moves and a passionate advocate for empowerment through choreography and dance. Welcome, Lapri.
Hi, Uvo. How are you?
Thank you so much for having me.
So
good to have you. Now, Lapri, can you tell us how you got into the world of dance and choreography?
There's not a time where I remember being in this world, but I just remember as a kid always being somebody that has always been a dancer, always dancing in my mom's parties. And then obviously when I came this side, it became more materialized as a profession, but I've always been dancing since I could remember.
That's so beautiful. And I can imagine it myself, like in those parties, those halls, and that kid in the center of the dance hall just showed the moves, and all the adults are like, oh my goodness, look at her move. And that brought you into the world of a professional life as a dancer. What is that life like?
I suppose it's very busy. Like, obviously, coming from South Africa to this side, there's a huge difference. And I think, obviously, when I came, I was kind of looking to connect with some people through the love of dance, and there wasn't much of what I knew. So I remember my friend recommending me to go to one of my other friends, Bami Kute. She used to do these twerk classes in Dublin. And during that time, obviously, there wasn't a lot of people, but she was so inspirational to me. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to find my tribe. And since then, it's been like a busy, busy industry, doing like loads of gigs, such as like Africa Day. We do like shows. We work with corporate companies. And sometimes I travel to do the same thing, like to teach classes abroad and stuff. So it is quite a very ongoing and hectic job. But I do enjoy it so much so because, you know, you connect with different people from all over the world. And no working day is boring, actually.
That's so beautiful. And a lot of people don't ever imagine like having art as a job. There can be a lot of conflicting things, but that sense of excitement, I can really hear it through your voice. And I know you started Southside Moves. Can you tell us about that and what inspired that?
Yeah, I suppose it's like finding your tribe. I think that was the biggest why. And also finding people that I could connect with on a bigger scale as well, like using our body as well. I think obviously when I started, it was more so just to get people that enjoy dancing to the same music as me. Then over time, it was more so to build a community that would exist even when I'm not around. Because I found that sometimes when I wasn't there to teach classes, then there'd be nobody dancing that week or month, depending on what I was busy with. But now we have a huge ecosystem that works really well. I have a couple of assistants that also teach classes when I travel. Our community meets up for like night outs or like get togethers for game night, birthdays, even when I'm not in that space, which is something that I'm really, really, really happy about. Southside Moves is basically a place where people can feel like they can belong, you know? And we have like over 200 students over the last couple of years that came through to connect with each other through dance. And it's just a beautiful community to see, which is so loving and welcoming.
That's so beautiful. And dance is one of the ways that we can connect across cultures, across identity lines. So it's really great to hear how Southside Moves is doing that. Well done. And I know your focus and the dance that you find super interesting is that Afro Amapiano dance. Can you tell us more about that?
So essentially, like, Afro is basically like an umbrella term for all African dance styles. So that could obviously include like Azonto from Ghana, Nigeria, street styles from Nigeria. We also have Amapiano in that from South Africa, or like different kinds of dance with within different African countries. Usually when we say Afro, we want to say that this is like a fusion of these styles, depending on like obviously like the class level and stuff like that, whereas I specialize in Amapiano, which is a style from South Africa, which is quite recent over the last 10 years, and it's an ongoing, very popular one all over the world. However, Afro would be also something that I dabble in as well, in terms of mixing the styles all together, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And I suppose like the Amapiano dance style has become like super popular.
Oh my
God.
I've
seen you on Instagram. I'm trying to do the moves, can't do the moves. But specifically,
it's really tough.
But specifically, how do you feel it's grown over the past couple of years through social media and all these kind of things?
Yeah, I think obviously like music and dance are so interconnected. And obviously music and dance cannot exist without each other. I think even now looking at the artists and how they promote songs is through dance challenges. And obviously Amapiano started off back in the day more like a soulful Sunday session where, you know, people would meet up on Sundays just to play really chill music. And of course Amapiano music is known to be like a very long song. The intro takes so long. By the time you get to the part that's so interesting, people would have not really checked out if you're not used to that style, but it's kind of like, oh yeah, the song is still ongoing. But in terms of dance, it obviously has been popularized through like social media. And I think obviously dance plays a huge role in the way that most songs are being pushed lately. So yeah, the history of Amapiano is quite broad. So I feel like if I talk about it, we'll be here all day.
I can imagine. And specifically Amapiano, and like you said, other parts of Africa as well, there's such a diversity in that. And do you find that it's like misconceptions around like Afro and Amapiano dance styles when you're teaching it?
Well, yeah, I think like, for example, the reason why I kind of separated the two styles was for people to know that I specialize in Amapiano, but Amapiano also falls under the category of Afro as a style, because it is, again, like Afro is an umbrella term for all African dance styles. So usually what we would have to do is to make it clear, especially when we're teaching, to say that, okay, if I'm doing an Afrofusion class, the people then who are attending would expect to know that they're gonna maybe have something from Ghana, something from, I don't know, Tanzania, something from South Africa, something from Nigeria, or something that's a mixture within all African dance styles. Because obviously Africa is a continent and there's multiple countries, and within those countries we have multiple tribes and styles and cultures. So obviously when you teach those classes, it's not very in depth with one style. It is like you touching here and touching there. So as a teacher, you kind of have to make it clear Because there are some people that get confused when we say, oh, I'm going to an Amapiano class or I'm going to an Afro class. And what does that mean? You know,
there's so much history behind it. And there's so much thought, because like you said, there is, it is 52 plus countries and so many identities and ethnicities that are involved. And can you walk us through like the process of actually like building the choreography for a class?
So like it depends on the level. At Southside, we have two classes. We have the beginner basics and then we have the intermediate level. So like when you prepare for a class, depending on the level, I think the beginner is something I can talk about now. You kind of want to see what you want people to learn from you in the class. That could include learning the names of the steps, first of all, and also the technique and the foundation and the groove. So the three things that I mostly would focus on is like them understanding that you need to bend your knees in Afro. Like if you've got bad knees,
no,
I'm
stiff
so
knees.
Sorry, literally. That's one of the things. And then obviously facial expressions, because, you know, a lot of African dancers are very much expressive in their face. And I think what we enjoy about African dance styles is that you are enjoying watching the person enjoy themselves while they dance. And then the last thing is groove. And obviously when we think of groove, we think of things, the groove is like a feeling of how you feel whenever you dance. And we see other people, they have this naturalness to them that you know that they don't have to left feet. So those are the things that we focus on in the beginner class. With that, then you teach them the steps of the style, and then you drill those. By drilling, I mean like you go over them over and over until it kind of sticks. And then from there, we build up to like combos. And then obviously the combo would be used in a choreography class. However, everybody teaches differently. I think this is just a style that's worked for me in for me to see how my students are able to grasp it and grow.
And folks, if you want to get out of your head, if you want to move your body, if you want to just be, you can attend Lapri Lala's classes at southsidemoves.com. Lapri, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Fantastic. Now, folks, after the break, we'll be celebrating the Filipino Festival in Ireland. That's coming up on Unified after the break. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Unified. And from incredible food to live music, history, culture, dance, art, Dublin, Philippines.